when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Välkommen till Rika Tillsammans. Detta är dagens avsnitt.
De flesta aktiva förvaltare slår inte index den mesta av tiden.
En ny rapport som tittar på 20 års historik när man jämfört då de som är aktivt försöker förutsäga framtiden, välja ut investeringar som kommer gå bättre än andra versus index, att bara köpa allting, visar ganska tydliga resultat.
Och tre anledningar till att aktiva investerare inte slår index.
Och resultatet är inte tillfälligt, utan där finns grundläggande anledningar till att aktiva förvaltare och aktiva småsparare inte slår index över tid, och detta lär sannolikt fortsätta även i framtiden.
Förra årets avkastning säger ingenting om årets avkastning.
Ett av de mest populära sätten att välja en investering, det är ju att titta så här, hur gick den förra året? Vi har stjärnor och vi har liksom grafer. Men den här studien över 20 har visat att det finns liksom inget samband med något, att något som gick bra förra året kommer att gå bra även i år.
Du får inte betalt för att lägga ner tid och engagemang.
Till skillnad från de flesta andra aktiviteter där den som gör mest, kan mest, engagerar sig mest, kommer få bäst resultat, så kommer i sparande den som är passiv, lat, oengagerad, ointresserad, oinloggad få bäst resultat.
Varmt välkommen till Rika Tillsammans-podden som handlar om allt som är roligt med privatekonomi och livet. Varje vecka delar vi med oss av vår livsresa, våra erfarenheter, framgångar och misstag så att du ska kunna göra din ekonomi, ditt sparande och ditt liv lite rikare. Vi som driver denna podden heter Caroline och Jan Bolmesson.
Välkommen till dagens avsnitt som är 302 i ordningen, och detta har ju varit ett avsnitt som jag har sett fram emot ganska mycket.
Lite med skräckblandad förtjusning ändå.
Ja, men eller hur, för att vi intervjuar en amerikan, Craig Lacera, som jobbar på S&P, som är då Standard & Poor, de som ger ut S&P 500, liksom indexet. Och han har de senaste 14 åren jobbat på deras SPIVA då, som står för Standard & Poor Active, eller Index versus Active. Mm. Så att de har liksom i 20 år forskat på det och försökt hålla poängen att liksom, hur går det för de som har gett sina pengar till aktiva fondförvaltare versus de som bara köpt en indexfond och gjort så som vi pratar enligt forskningen. Mm. Och även om inte dagens avsnitt handlar om småsparen, så kan man absolut applicera det på småsparare. Så detta avsnittet är ju lite så här, det vi har försökt säga, eller det jag har försökt säga i många år, och detta är typ en av auktoriteterna på området, och jag fick liksom så här jobba ihop modet att ta kontakt med honom.
Yeah.
Men vad stack ut för dig i avsnittet?
Nej, men han pratade ju väldigt mycket och väldigt detaljerat, men det som jag ändå fick med mig, det var ju det att aktiv vinner ju typ aldrig mot passiv.
Nej, precis. Alltså det är så här att man har oddsen massivt, man har oddsen massivt emot sig. Nej, men eller hur? Nej, men jag tyckte detta var så här superspännande. Avsnittet är på engelska eftersom han är ju amerikan, så att podden här framgent kommer att vara på engelska, men på YouTube har vi textat det och på bloggen finns det också transkriberat. Där kan man läsa liksom på svenska.
Ja, vi har verkligen försökt göra det tillgängligt.
Ja, men det känns på det så här, vet, om någon pratar med en så kan man liksom säga, men titta här, titta på detta avsnittet, lyssna på liksom chefen för S&P.
Ja, eller så kan man bara för sin egen del liksom känna sig okej, okay, men
trygg.
Nu har jag...
Man kan känna sig trygg i att när man så här, nej men nu har jag inte bara lyssnat på Jan och Caroline på Riket Sammans, utan där finns genuint sjukt mycket data som visar det. Och sen tycker jag han är jätteduktig på metaforer, det tror jag nog med mig. Han har många bra exempel som är så här, de ska jag sno. Liksom. Det sista jag tänkte säga innan vi kör igång, S&P innan de släppte på Craig sa så här, ni måste visa den här disclaimern att liksom alla åsikter är våra egna, de gör ingen rekommendation hur man ska investera eller vilka fonder man ska välja eller någonting, så att där finns en disclaimer här också i beskrivningen och den. Och så tänker jag att vi ses nästa vecka helt enkelt. Ja. Och skriv gärna en kommentar, för att jag själv är så här bra. Åh, detta kan vara ett av mina favoritavsnitt, så det vore roligt att höra om ditt guldkorn, vad du tar med dig. Vi ses! Very welcome, Craig Lacerra. You're the managing director at S&P and Dow Jones Indices. You're also a chartered financial analyst, CFA. You studied at Harvard and Princeton, and you've been working in leadership roles in the finance industry since 1977, which I kind of realized is before I was born. So thank you very much for joining our show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Now, you made me feel old already. But
No.
Sorry. That comes with experienced.
Yeah. Good. That's better. Seasoned is a word I often use. Seasoned. Yeah.
Is there something you want to add to the introduction?
No. That's all fine. I just mentioned that I joined S&P Dow Jones. It'll be almost 14 years. So in the summer of 2009, and have had a variety of roles there. And what I do now is mainly centered around research on our basic indices and factor indices, and trying to be an advocate in the active versus passive debate. You can guess on which side.
Yeah, well, and that's what we're so looking forward to, and our listeners as well. And you work with this, you call this SPIVA. Could you explain what SPIVA is and the purpose of it?
SPIVA, S-P-I-V-A, it stands for S&P Indices versus Active. It's a scorecard, now 20 years old, a little more than that in the U.S. What SPIVA does is to look at a database of actively managed mutual funds, and then asked the question, another number of questions, but the primary one is, what fraction of actively managed funds have outperformed a benchmark that is appropriate to their investment style? So for example, in the US, we'll compare large cap actively managed funds to the S&P 500, mid cap funds to the S&P mid cap 400, you know, growth against growth, value against value. So as nearly as we can make it, it's an apples to apples comparison. And SPIVA, as I say, has been around in the U.S. Since 2002, so we've been a little bit past 20 years now. And we've introduced it in other geographies whenever we could find a sufficiently robust database to work on. Sufficiently robust, I should probably mention. What I really mean by that is a database that is adjusted for survivor bias. What that means is if you were to say, go out right now and say, I want to look at all the records of all of the funds that have a 20-year record and ask how have they done versus an index, you're biasing the result because you're not looking at all the funds that existed 20 years ago. You're looking only at the funds that existed 20 years ago and were good enough to survive. And so there's an automatic need to adjust for what a statistician would call survivor bias, and that's a big part of what we do in SPIVA.
How come that you started this?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting question, and I would like to think of SPIVA, and I do think of SPIVA as a continuation of in a long line of research by academics and others. The earliest study of which I'm aware that compared actively managed portfolios to passive benchmarks literally was published in 1932, or maybe 33. So it's 90 years old. That was very much a one-off. But in the 1970s, we began to see a number of articles, and I can cite some of them for you. One of them is relatively famous, called The Loser's Game by a man named Charles Ellis. Another called Challenge to Judgment by Paul Samuelson. And these articles and others of that nature, that time period, began to do the same thing then that Spiva has done more recently, which is to say, let's compare the results of actively managed portfolios to passive benchmarks. And what Ellis and Samuelson and others found in the 1970s was the same thing that we have found with Spiva now 50 years later, which is that typically the majority of active managers underperform a benchmark that is appropriate to their investment style. That, parenthetically, is what led to the growth of the index fund industry. I mean, indices per se have been around for more than 100 years. I mean, the Dow Jones Industrial Average goes back, I think, to 1896. The S&P 500 in its current form of 500 stocks started in 1957, but its historical antecedent goes back to, I think, 1922 or 23. So indices have been around for a long time. Index funds only began to be seen in the 1970s. And the reason for that, in my view, is that in the 1970s, we began to see the research that I mentioned, the Samuelson, Malkiel, another name.
Alan Sharp as well.
Many others around that time period who began to look at the data and say, well, look, the obvious observation to make is that most active managers underperform most of the time. So why not simply own the benchmark and you'll end up outperforming most active funds?
Mm. And then you release, like twice a year, you release what you call the Spiva scorecard. Mm-hmm. Could you describe it? Because I sometimes refer our listeners to your website because it's kind of hard to read academic literature, but your homepage is like really easy. You show the world map and then you show just a graph. Can you describe the Spiva scorecard?
Sure. The Spiva scorecard is simply at its most basic form, it tells you in a particular period of time what fraction of managers outperformed or underperformed a passive benchmark. So for example, we issued less than a month ago our 2022 update for the United States. 51% of all large cap active funds underperformed the S&P 500. That's kind of the headline of U.S. Spiva. And then, of course, we'll look not only at 1 year look backs. We'll look at 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. We look at mid cap. We look at small cap. We look at fixed income. We look at international outside the U.S. So all of these. All of these categories, if you will be tracked in Spiva, and we'll report every 6 months, as you say, what fraction of managers outperformed, what fraction underperformed.
Hmm. But for the critical listener, how do you ensure that this report is not biased, considering that it's coming from you who are... Yeah. You know, of your
an index provider.
Index provider.
Yes. We are talking our own book. I admit that. I think there are two things to say. One is that the data we use, we don't compile. They come from in the case of the U.S., the University of Chicago Center for Research and Securities Prices. So and wherever outside the U.S. is always a third party provider. We don't assemble the data. So anyone who reads Spiva doesn't have to worry about S&P just cherry picking the managers that we want to evaluate. The managers come to us in an external database. The second thing to say is there's not much fancy analysis. It's just a question of here's what the returns of the managers were. Here's what the benchmark was. Here's how many outperformed. Here's how many underperformed. And I guess the third thing I'd mention is that if you don't like the way we do it, you can look at other institutions that do something similar. For example, Morningstar in the U.S., which is not a passive. I mean, they have a passive business, but is mainly an advice giver to active managers. Morningstar does a similar study with similar results. Merrill Lynch often publishes a similar study with similar results. And I mentioned already, you know, things going back 50 and in one case 90 years of similar studies doing similar results. So it's you know, I like to think of SPIVA, as I said, as a continuation of that academic research that really got going in high gear in the 1970s.
Yeah. And looking back at the last 20 years, what are the most important points that you think are worth noting or mentioning?
I'll mention two observations and then a conjecture if I can. The observations are, one of them I've alluded to already, and that is that most active managers underperform most of the time. I mentioned earlier that in the U.S. in 2022, 51% of large cap managers outperform the S&P 500. So that's basically a coin flip. That's a huge improvement over time. The average, if you look at 20 years of data, is something like 63-64% underperformers. The last calendar
on a one-year basis.
On a one-year basis, yes, on a one-year basis. We'll come to the other later. On a one-year basis. The last full calendar year in which a majority of active managers outperformed was 2009. So it's been a long stretch. So the most important conclusion of SPIVA is that most active managers underperform most of the time. A second conclusion, which we also derive, it's a companion report that uses the same database. It's called the Persistence Scorecard. And the Persistence Scorecard began to be, we began to do persistent scorecards because active managers would argue that, you know, well, it may be true that the majority of active managers underperform a passive benchmark, but that doesn't mean that there aren't some who are consistently above average. And that's entirely plausible. Those things could both be true at the same time. But the SPIVA data give us a way to check or to inquire, at least, about the assumption that some active managers are consistently above average. So what we do in the persistence scorecard is really quite simple. There are a number of cuts at the data you can take. I'll just tell you one of my favorites. Most important thing about SPIVA is that most active managers underperform most of the time. The second thing that is important in these data comes from a companion piece to SPIVA that we call the persistence scorecard. And the persistence scorecard we initiated because some active managers, in reaction to SPIVA said, well, it may be true that the majority of active managers underperform, but that doesn't mean it isn't possible for some to be above average on a consistent basis. And that is a plausible statement. There's no necessary reason that can't be true. And the SPIVA data give us a way to inquire to see whether it is true or not. So that's what we do in the persistence scorecard, and there are many ways to cut the data. I'll tell you my favorite of the many that we do in persistence, and that is simply, it's very simple. Take 10 years of data, look at the first 5 years, say I want to identify all of the managers who are above median performer in the first 5 years. So you take the top half of the distribution. And then you ask the question, how many of these guys who were in the top half in the first 5 years were also in the top half in the second 5 years? And obviously, if there is strong persistence in manager skill, then you would expect a very large majority, I mean, not 100% certainly, but you'd expect a very substantial majority to be of those who were above average in the first 5 years, also to be above average in the second 5 years. If performance is completely random, you would expect that 50% of those who were above average in the first 5 years would be above average in the second 5 years. And what you find is, in fact, somewhat worse than that. The most recent data that I recall is that I think 42% of all the managers who were above median in the first 5 years were also above median in the second 5 years, which is less than you would expect simply from flipping a coin. So the SPIVA data therefore tell you, not only the average active manager underperforms most of the time, but that when you see success historically, it is not a good predictor of success in the future. So in other words, success last year does not predict success this year. And those two things, lead, those are just simply observations of the data. They lead to what I will call a conjecture or an assertion. I believe it to be true, but you can't absolutely prove from the data. And that is that these things are not an accident. They arise not because there was a cosmic coin flip 50 years ago. God flipped a coin. The active managers said heads and it came up tails. That's not what happened. The results that we see in SPIVA and persistence come about for some very good identifiable and strong reasons, and the reasons are likely to persist, and therefore the results are likely to persist as well.
Could you give examples of those reasons?
Yeah, I can identify three main reasons why active management tends to underperform. The first and simplest is simply cost. There's a wonderful article that you're probably aware of, the best article I've ever read on investment management by William Sharp called The Arithmetic of Active Management. And it just looks at this very issue, how costs affect active and passive management differently. And he comes up with a conclusion, just not looking at data, just theoretically, and the data, of course, back it up, that the average active fund will underperform. So that's the first thing, cost. The second reason has to do with what I would call the professionalization of the investment management business. What I mean by that is that in any market, there is no source of outperformance for the outperformers other than the underperformance of the underperformers. So if you get a group of people in a room and say, look, if all of us in this room are all of the investors in the U.S. stock market, if I'm going to be above average, at least one of you is going to be below average. And if the left side of the room is everybody who's above average, then the weighted average sum of their outperformance is exactly equal before cost to the weighted average sum of the underperformance of all the guys on the other side of the room. So that professionalization becomes an issue. Now, what that means is, and this is something that's interesting historically, because if you go back, say, 50 years, or 60 or 70 now, the U.S. market was not particularly professionalized. Most assets were managed by individual investors, maybe advised by retail brokers. The professionals were a relatively small fraction of the assets under management. They had tremendous advantages in terms of information access, ability to trade cheaply, access to management, good fundamental research. All of those advantages applied to the professionals, but not to the, I like to call them undiversified amateurs. And I say that lovingly. It sounds like a pejorative term. It's not. You know, my grandmother was an undiversified amateur. I mentioned earlier an article by Charlie Ellis, published, I think, in 1975, called The Loser's Game. And it's a wonderful story of exactly what we're talking about now. In other words, the history in Charlie's telling of the post-war U.S. equity market, then only 30 years old. And basically, he told the story better than I have, but he told the story of how, you know, in the 1950s, you know, the amateurs were a small group and it was easy for them to outperform. And then as the business became more and more institutionalized, that became less and less likely and less possible until you get to the 1970s when investment management became what Charlie called a loser's game. That is why, by the way, in my view, what I said earlier, indices have been around for a long time, but index funds only started in the 1970s. Why the 1970s? Why not 20 years sooner? Why not 20 years later? Because by the 1970s, the U.S. market had become largely professionalized, and that's where indexing started. So that's the second thing. I mean, cost, professionalization.
Yeah. I'm thinking because I've seen these studies also that the available alpha kind of decreased, and even like Warren Buffett, he had like strong overperformance until like the 2000s. And yeah. I think, I don't know, have you read the article by Michael Mabusin, which The Paradox of Skill?
Yes.
Because is that a factor as well? Because what he says is when the skill increases, which you argue, which I kind of understand that you argue, when the skill increases with the market participants, then the importance of luck increases because it's there's a kind of random element to it.
Yeah, that's, would, that's would you, that, That's an excellent point. Yes, no, I think that's correct. And it's funny. We began to think about this. I want to say probably 8 or 9 years ago. I was at a conference in Chicago, and there were a number of hedge fund managers there, and they were saying exactly the same thing you were saying, which is it's gotten so much harder. You know, the supply of alpha seems to have gone down. And I tell people, if it were possible to feel sorry for a bunch of guys who make millions of dollars a year running hedge funds, you know, we'd all felt very sorry for them because, guys, this is getting so much harder. And so that started us to think about it. And I think here's our take on it. I think, you know, Mulbison is exactly right in terms of talking about the growth of skill. You have to distinguish between the absolute level of skill and the relative level of skill. And if I think about the average active manager, at least the ones I meet, which is a subset, obviously, but they know a lot. They're smart people. They work hard. They're well informed. I mean, their absolute level of ability at valuing companies and understanding businesses is very strong. I'm sure much stronger than most retail investors. So their absolute ability is very strong. The trouble is, it doesn't matter. Their absolute ability what matters in terms of their ability to outperform or underperform is not their absolute level of ability, it's their relative level of ability. And unless they can be consistently above average, and that's difficult because of the things we've been discussing, you know, the supply of alpha, cost, skewness, unless they can be consistently above average, they're of no value. There's a fascinating article. I don't usually cite it because it's kind of heavy going, but it goes back to the late 70s, early 80s, called The Nature of the Game by a man named Hal Arbit, A-R-B-I-T. And I've never forgotten this comment that Arbit made. It said in most professional activities, an average professional is perfectly good. I mean, if you have a cold, an average doctor can help you get better. Or, you know, if you have a legal matter to deal with, you know, an average lawyer can probably handle it for you. Maybe even a below average lawyer. You don't always need the best around. He said, investment management is unique in that the average result is available for free. Go buy an index fund. You'll get the average result. 50 some years ago, there were no index funds. Then an index alternative became available. Then people began to move money from active portfolios to index portfolios. When that happened, presumably it was the least capable active managers who lost the most assets. What that means is, because remember we said there's no source of outperformance for the winners other than the underperformance of the losers. If the losers as a group get better because the worst of them have been driven out of business, the underperformance of the losers becomes less. And if the underperformance of the losers is less, the outperformance of the winners mathematically has also to be less. So as the least capable active managers leave the business or have their assets reduced, they don't leave altogether necessarily, but as they lose assets, the average level of ability of the active managers goes up. And it becomes more difficult to be above average. I mean, a crude analogy, I'm very fond of it, but a crude analogy is that the lion catches the slowest zebra in the herd. Once the lion catches the slowest zebra, the average speed of the herd goes up. So when the lion comes around hungry next week, it's going to be harder to be at the front of the herd because the slower guys have already been eliminated. There's a wonderful story or a wonderful article I when you mentioned the supply of alpha and Warren Buffett, I couldn't help think of this. Charlie Munger, who's Warren Buffett's partner, in I think it was 2018 or 19, I forget the year, but no farther back than that, did a long interview with the Wall Street Journal. They went out to his house in Los Angeles and interviewed. He was like 95 years old at the time, so that we've got to go soon. We can't wait, you know, can't wait 10 more years. So they went out to interview. And he's a fascinating man, just really, really, really interesting. And most of the article was about his interests other than about investments. Architecture, philanthropy. It's really just a wonderful read. The article is called Charlie Munger Unplugged. So anybody who wants to can find it. But of course, at some point they asked him, well, you know, Charlie, how have things changed since you and Warren started in business? And like this goes back to the 1960s. And he said, oh, it's much, much harder. They said, when we were young, we had idiot competition. And idiot competition is a direct quotation. You don't take my word for it. Even Charlie Munger will tell you the level of competition has gone up. And I would attribute that to the availability of alternatives to poor active managers. And so as the least capable active managers lose assets, indexing grows, the average level of the active managers who survive is higher, and outperforming becomes harder and harder. If you look at the average year, let's say the 20 years between 2021 and 2022, or 2001 and 2022, on average, maybe 63, 64% of large cap managers underperform the S&P 500. If you look back 10 years or 20 years, it's like 95% have underperformed the S&P 500. And similarly for other for subsets of other asset classes, mid-cap, small-cap, and so forth. So performance gets to be much, much harder. Outperformance, I should say, is much, much harder as the time period lengthens. The data are very clear that if you simply invest in a well-diversified large-cap well-diversified large-cap, mid-cap, small-cap index fund, you will probably outperform and historically have outperformed 90-some percent of all the active managers investing in the same asset class. And you'll do that at lower cost, with more reliability, and as you say, without having to do the work of active management or worry about hiring someone else to do it for you.
I read this as there was some American bond manager who called this strategic mediocrity. That his goal wasn't to be the top, because if you were in the top, you had to take some risk, which sooner or later blew you up. So his goal was to be, I think, top 20%. And then he realized, if I'm in the top 20% for the next coming 10 years, I'm going to be in the top 10%. And I was like, this is brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, you don't. It's even easier than that. But that's correct. I mean, if you can be a little above average, pretty reliably year to year, you're going to be way above average when you come back 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. So no, that's one of the problems, or one of the challenges I think that indexing has, is that it does give you the return. It gives you the market's return, gives you the average return of the dollars that are invested in the U.S. market or whatever market it is. Gives you the average return of the average dollar invested in that stock. And of course, people say, well, I want to be above average. I want to be above average. And so therefore they'll reach for this extra return. There was a wonderful interview. I mentioned Charlie Ellis earlier. There was a wonderful interview that I saw Charlie give some years ago. And this very thing came up. Someone said, well, Charlie, don't they want to be above average? He said, well, of course they want to. Of course people want to be above average, and that's, you know, one of the things that's led to human growth and flourishing is the desire of people to improve themselves. And the good news is, if you simply put your money in a low-cost comprehensive index fund, you are almost guaranteed not only to be above average, but to be in the top quintile when you go back and look at your results 10 or 20 years from now. And that's true. There's a third reason we mentioned earlier. We're talking about why is it that the Spiva results are the way they are. There's one that kind of comes right directly to this point. The first two reasons, of course, were cost and professionalization. The third reason has to do with what I like to call skewness. Sounds complicated, really not. You know what a bell curve looks like? Obviously, you know, half the observations above the mean, half the observations below the mean. Stock returns don't look like that. And you might suspect that that's true because a stock can only go down 100%. It can go up 100, 200, 300. So there's naturally what statisticians call a positive skewness or right skewness. If you plot the graph, there's a long tail to the right side. And that's very common. If we had, you know, 100 people in a room and we took heights and weights, I guarantee it's skewed to the right because, you know, nobody's much shorter than 5 feet tall, or there's somebody who's 6 feet three going to pull the average up. You know, it happens all the time. Very common. But it also happens with stock returns. So if you look at individual years, I think we have 31 or two years of data for the S&P 500. And I think in 27 of them, returns are skewed to the right. A good quick measure of that is to say, is the average bigger than the median? If the average is bigger than the median, it got to be that way because some big observations are pulling the average up. So that's a good look. And by the way, it's not a U.S. phenomenon. Europe, Australia, Asia, they all look this way. I've never seen a market that doesn't look this way. Now, where you really see it, however, is over a long period of time. So if you look, for example, at the 20 years ended in 2022 for the S&P 500. Look at all the stocks that were constituents of the S&P 500 only for the time they were in the index. If they came in or went out, we only count them while they were there. The median stock was up 91%. The average was up 300% because you have some really strong performers pulling the average up. Over that 20-year period, only, I think, 18% of the stocks in the index outperformed the index. Now, what that means, two things. One thing it means, and it comes back to the SPIVA issue, is that I would have thought before looking at data like this that if a manager could consistently pick stocks that were above median, great, he'd end up above median. Above average. Not so, because it's actually much harder than that. The average is much higher than the median, especially over long periods of time. So that's the first thing. It helps explain why the average manager underperforms. And then secondly, it comes back to the point we were making earlier. Over short periods of time, a year, typically a majority of active managers underperform the market. Over long periods of time, 20 years, or so, then the overwhelming majority underperform. And I think those two things are connected as well.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I haven't thought of it about that way, but you're rationally, logically says, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. We did it. There was an art, and this discussion, as it comes up with me, there's a fund back in the 1990s. I won't mention the name, but it the name of the fund company with 20 after it owned 20 stocks. And this fund did really, really well because they were basically 20 technology stocks. So it did really, really well. In the late 1990s, got lots of assets into it. And then, of course, you know what happened to technology, and the fund began to do very, very badly. And everybody in the late 90s said, well, this is evidence that what you should do is be more concentrated. That's why it's doing so well. So I said, no, it would have done almost as well if they just bought the technology sector as a whole. But that's what was driving it. It was not concentration. It was a lucky sectoral bet. And the same argument comes up. Every 20 years or so, we begin to see it. My colleague Tim Edwards and I did a paper. Oh my goodness, it's probably 7 or 8 years old now, because we had seen some of this discussion about you should be more concentrated, and we called the paper "Fooled by Conviction," which I summarizes what we thought of the idea. But that's one of the reasons is this skewness idea.
Yeah. If we go back to, you said earlier, most active managers underperform most of the time. Is this true for institutional managers as well?
It is. We have the original SPIVA database, when the current database, is mutual funds. We've done a couple adjustments to allow for the possibility that, you know, that other, you know, non-mutual fund investors, like pension funds or otherwise, do better. There's an institutional version of SPIVA. Now, the data there are much harder to come by because SPIVA, you know, mutual funds are required by law to report their results. It's easy to get a survivor-adjusted database. Can't really do that as easily with pension funds, but we've done it where we can, using, you know, the best database we can find, and the results are very comparable to SPIVA. The other thing we do is to look at the SPIVA database, because SPIVA, we simply use the change in net asset value of mutual funds to calculate mutual fund performance. And people rightly observe, well, you know, an institutional portfolio manager would be, an institutional portfolio would not pay the same fee that a retail mutual fund would pay. So we add back the expense ratio and look at the SPIVA data gross of funds. Now, obviously, gross of fees, a few more managers outperform than net of fees, because if you didn't have to pay the fee, you'd do better. But the conclusions don't change. The conclusions don't change at all. And in fact, that's very consistent with the argument we were discussing earlier about the reason the results are the way they are is because of things like professionalization and cost and skewness, and they affect pension funds or endowments or hedge funds just as much as they affect retail mutual funds.
Yeah. So the conclusion is that both net of fees and gross of fees, most active managers underperform most of the time.
Correct.
Yeah. And there's also sometimes talk about adjusting for risk. Mm-hmm. And I think that you do that in your report as well. Could you say something about that?
We do. You can risk adjust the results. And you find, again, we did a summary of 20 years of SPIVA not too long ago. And one of the things we said was, what are the conclusions of SPIVA? Most active managers underperform most of the time. Second, risk adjusted. Most active managers underperform most of the time. Third, adding back their fees. Most active managers underperform most of the time. It's kind of a universal conclusion. I will say, interestingly, because the issue of risk comes up every now and then, Tim Edwards and I did a paper quite a few years ago, just looking at the riskiness of portfolios in the SPIVA database and saying, what fraction of actively managed funds are less volatile than their benchmarks? And I believe it's been a while. I believe the answer is something like 20% are less volatile, 80% are more volatile. So the idea that risk reduction is a benefit of active management, it's plausible, but it's not true if you look at the data.
Cool. And you also said that, I think in this 20 years assessing a SPIVA, which you did with Tim Edwards, you also wrote that the tendency for underperformance typically rises as the observation period lengthens. I know that you said it earlier,
yes. But
it's not the longer period we have, the more conclusive the results are, one could say.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. Could I just one more? I know. What I've been missing is that sometimes we talk with our community and there are like a lot of retail investors and they say, oh yeah, but these studies are for institutional managers and they are for fund managers, but I'm a retail investor, so it doesn't apply to me. And I'm like, I wouldn't draw that conclusion. What's your opinion?
No, it absolutely applies to you. I mean, you may choose to ignore it, but it certainly applies to you. The SPIVA database and the equivalent databases all over the world are drawn from mutual funds that are available to retail investors. There's no data of which I'm aware that in any market that says the majority of active managers in this particular market are likely to outperform. And what I say to people, retail or institutional, is always because some people want active management. There's nothing wrong with doing active management if you want to do it with your own money, but realize the odds are against you. That's all. That's what SPIVA persistence is saying, which 90 years of research is saying. The odds are against you.
But why do you think that most managers and investors still try to beat the market, even though research says it's impossible?
The odds are against them.
Yeah, I think there's two separate answers. One is why do the managers do it, and the second is why do their clients permit them to do it? I think in the manager's case, it's fairly. I always say we have the active passive debate. I said there'll always be an active passive debate because they'll never surrender. It's too profitable.
It's instinctual to humans, as you said before.
I'm speaking of the managers themselves. Not the clients. Now we come to
okay.
It's a profit. It's a very profitable activity for the managers, even if they're not successful. In investment terms, they can be successful financially for themselves. That's one thing. Now we come to the clients. Why is it that clients want to believe in active management? And I think it comes back. Now I'm obviously speculating, but I think we're instinctively hardwired somehow to believe that the past predicts the future. And from an evolutionary standpoint, that's probably a really good bias to have, because I know if I go back to London one day, they will drive on the left side of the road. Why do I know that? Because every time I've been there, that's the way they do it. If I come back to Sweden, they drive on the right side of the road. Why do I know that? Because I've been there and I know. So it's those are very useful things to know. Why do I come? I'm driving down the street in a strange place and there's a red sign. What do? I stop because red means stop. I mean, so it's a useful heuristic. And I think you can argue it goes back to caveman days when, we're all, at risk of being eaten by the saber-toothed tiger. And you knew when the tiger was out, you didn't come out of the cave because your neighbor had been eaten last week. So this notion of learning from the past is very useful in most of life, just not here. There's too much randomness in investment management. So how is investment management sold? Typically in terms of performance. So the marketing people will say, here, look at how well we did last year for the last 3 years, last 5 years, whatever their record is. And your natural assumption, if you're not steeped in the literature as you obviously are, and as I try to be, if you're not steeped in the literature, your natural reaction is, well, yeah, the guy who did so well last year, he must be the best. And in most of life, that's, look at the best. We call it soccer. The best football player, the best U.S. football player, the best basketball, the best baseball. The guys who were really good last year, they're going to be good this year. It's because skill is really important there. The randomness isn't nearly so big. In investment management, randomness is really big. And I come back to the paradox of skill that you raised earlier. Mm. As the level of skill across investors, in this case, professional investors, has increased, the importance of luck goes way up.
Yeah, and it's totally counterintuitive, because like you say, in every other area of life, if you put in the effort, if you put in the time, you read the books, you go to training, and you do everything, you get better, and you get better results, and you get the belearning,
the reward.
You get the reward.
Yes.
But in investing, you can get the reward and you think, this is totally to do with something with my skill, but it was just pure luck. It's very difficult to untangle luck from skill in a result in the investment market.
Oh, very, very much. I'll tell you, if I can tell you my Michael Jordan story, which is one of my favorite stories. And it kind of is on this point. You can see my face, but you can't see all of me. But if you did, you would probably say, this guy is not a really natural athlete. And you would be right to draw that conclusion. And one of the things I'm particularly bad at as a sport is basketball. So I did an exercise several months ago. It may not be the best thing I've ever written, but I think it was the most fun. It was about shooting baskets with Michael Jordan. Now, Michael, for those of you listeners who don't know, Michael Jordan arguably is the best basketball player who ever played basketball. He's certainly in the top three or four. No one would argue that. And so we're gonna have a contest where I am gonna shoot free throws, the equivalent of penalty shots in football. I'm gonna shoot free throws against Michael Jordan. So how likely is it that either one of us will succeed. Well, there are statistics on Michael Jordan and his playing career. He made 83.5% of all his free throw shots. I was amazed that you could Google that. There it is, 83.5. I thought I'd have to make up a number. Oh, no, there it is, 83.5 for Michael Jordan. And I don't have a baseline for myself, but I thought, well, if I practice, let's say I can get up to 20%. So here we have these two contestants. There is a huge discrepancy in skill, 83.5 versus 20. So we step up to the line. We both make our first shot. There are four possible outcomes. We both make it. We both miss. I make mine and he misses. The greatest athletic achievement of my life, if it actually happened. And the most likely outcome, he makes his shot, I miss mine. Now, given the probabilities that we said, the most likely outcome, about 67% probability, is that he makes his shot, I miss mine. So after one round, 67% chance that Michael Jordan is beating me. But that means there is a 33% chance that I'm holding my own, which is ridiculous. There's no chance that I'm as good as this guy. But on a short observation period, one chance in three says I'm holding my own against Michael Jordan. Now, we do two rounds. I think my odds drop to like 5%. In three rounds, my odds dropped to, you know, 1 or 2%. After that, I didn't bother computing. because what that means is over a short period is three shots. Over time, luck diminishes. The only way I'm even with Michael after one round is luck. I get lucky and he gets unlucky. Over time, luck diminishes, skill persists. And so when we look at the Spieber results back in time, why is it that in a one-year period, maybe on average 65% of managers underperform, 35% outperform, but only 5 or 10% outperform over a 10 or 20 year period? It has a lot to do with the skill versus luck. Luck may help you in a single year. It's not going to help you for 10 years straight.
Can you summarize this like that? Above average past performance does not predict above average future performance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think you even wrote in some article that poor performance continued to be a reliable indicator of future fund closures.
That's clearly true. If you look at the Spiva data and you say, you go back 20 years and say, you know, what can you say that the past does predict? Well, you know, fourth quartile funds are much more likely to close than top quartile funds, yeah. Which is why you need to adjust for survivor bias, obviously.
Obviously. This is like kind of a personal question, because sometimes I feel like you're saying, I have the data, I'm talking to people, or I'm doing a lecture. And it's almost most fun within the finance industry, because then people say to me, so, look, I've read the same research. I agree with you. Most people should do this, or most fund managers should just do index funds. But I don't want, but I'm better. I'm better. I've outperformed the index, or I want to give myself the opportunity to do this. What do you say when you get into those situations?
Well, as I said earlier, any investor who says, I think I can outperform, I mean, there's no theology that says it can't happen, but the odds are against you. Realize that. If you have a manager who says, you know, historically I have underperformed, I mean, look very carefully at the, some have, you know, even over 20 years, you know, 5 or 10% has, it's not certain that he's lying, but be very careful in looking at performance data. I'll tell you one thing that particularly investors should be wary of. And it actually comes from I did a series of blog posts years ago called Performance Trickery. I'm up to part four now. I haven't added to it for a while. But the very first edition of Performance Trickery said, what happens, and I actually put some numbers down, made them up. Let's suppose you have a manager who has really kind of a mediocre record. He's up a little, down a little. He's basically underperforming by a modest amount for 10 years. And then he has a really good year. What's he going to show you when he markets his fund? He's going to show you his one-year record. his 3-year record, his 5-year record, his 10. He's going to show you all those periods, all of which include his single really good year. And he's going to say, look, I've done well over 10 years. I've done well over 5 years. He's not lying. The numbers are what he says, but he is tricking you because the implication of what he's saying is that he has consistently done well. The facts in the history are he's done well once, but he's done at he's using that as any good salesman would. He's using that to say, look, I've done well on a 1-year, 2-year, 3-year trailing basis. So the message of the performance trickery blog is when somebody gives you 10 years of data, look at individual years. Always disaggregate. You can hide a lot of stuff when you aggregate data. You don't have to.
Are there any other trickeries like this?
Well, there are a number of others. There's some. The other one that comes immediately to mind is occasionally managers will say, I'm going to present data not on a 1-year basis, but I'll show you like rolling 3-year periods or rolling 5 years. So I have a 10-year record. I'll show you every rolling 3-year period. Why do you do that? Well, if you only have one good year out of every three, and suddenly, that 1 year kind of serves to raise the average performance in all of the look back periods. So it's a way. I think the message as I think back on it of performance, the performance trickery series, is always disaggregate, always disaggregate. The final one, this I owe to a professor at Harvard, her giving a lecture, is to say, understand that a lot of fun companies will incubate or just have very small portfolios, their own money, and they might try 10 different strategies, which are quite different. And you come to the end of a 3 or 5 year period and say, which of these 10 strategies has done well? Let's say one of them's done really well. Guess what fund they launch? It's that one. So you just need to be careful about the way people use data and be. Look, if you keep in mind that for at least 50 and arguably 90 years, every bit of objective academic and practitioner research that's hit this question has found that the average active fund underperforms passive benchmarks. If you keep that in mind, let that be your touchstone, you won't go far wrong. And if you choose to say, I think I can be better, good luck. Somebody will, but you realize the odds are against you.
Yeah, definitely. Carol?
Okay, so we have a few people in our community that wants to ask some questions. André Granström asks, what is, in your opinion, the largest flaw with index investing?
The largest flaw?
Are there not any downsides with investing in an index fund? My favorite is that it's boring.
Oh well, that's clearly true. Yeah, I mean, from the standpoint of both buyers and sellers of investment management, I think yes, it's boring. It just you might own in some proportion the best performing stock. You may also own in some proportion the worst performing stocks. You'll never be able to tell your friends about the great buy you made, last month that doubled already. So it's interesting. I have an old professor friend named Meyer Statman who writes about motivations of investors a lot. He's a behavioral finance guy. And he said there are really three reasons that people buy investments, not investments of any sort. One of them is he calls utilitarian, which is what we've been talking about. Does it go up? How does it do? He said a second is expressive. You want to buy something because of what it says about you, mm-hmm. what you think it says about you. And the third is he calls it emotional. I kind of blend emotional and expressive together. Maybe I shouldn't do that, but there are all sorts of motivation. Index funds appeal to the utilitarian. They do not particularly appeal to the expressive. So, that may be part of it.
Mm. definitely. There is also an issue that sometimes is raised. I think you mentioned it in one of your blog articles the other day, which is kind of what happens if all the money goes into index funds? Like, do we have like a peak passive and market efficiency situation?
Yeah, that is a fascinating question. I think, let me just to set a baseline, our estimate, you have to guess because there's really no good data on this. Our estimate is that, let's say between a quarter and a third of the U.S. market today is in index trackers. When I say index trackers, I mean comprehensive cap-weighted indices, so S&P 500, Russell 1000, things like that. Not counting factor indices or what some people call smart beta, because they have a little bit of a different cast. So that's where we are now. And then you ask approximately where we are. And then you ask the question, what implication does that have for market efficiency? And to answer the question, you have to reflect on the fact, we have to do two things. One is, we've mentioned this already, that the fact that a quarter to a third of the market is indexed means that a quarter to a third is no longer under the control of the least capable active managers. So the fact of this body of index money has raised the average ability level of the active managers who are the people who ultimately keep the market efficient by their active trading. And now we come to the second point, which is how much active trading do you need to do in order, does there need to be in order for the market to be efficient? So we've asked, we published about this and asked the question a number of times to say, well, the thing you have to keep in mind is that active portfolios turn over at a much higher rate than index portfolios. I mean, in a heavy turnover year, the S&P 500 might turn over 5%. There's much more trading in active management, actively managed funds than there is in index funds. We did a model of this. You can do it many different ways. It's saying, what suppose the average active fund turns over, I think we said 50% per year, and the average index fund turns over at 10% per year. Both of those estimates are really conservative, at least by U.S. standards. And so that if you say that, or make any set of assumptions like that, if you do that, then you can compute for any given level of index assets, what fraction of the market, what fraction of trading is done by index funds. So if you say that 20% or 25% of all the assets are run by index funds, that means that roughly 7 or 8% of all the trading is done by index funds, 93% is still done by active managers. On those assumptions, you can get index assets up to something like 80, 82, 83% before active trading drops below 5%, 50%. So the majority of trading there's a very long runway ahead in which the majority of trading will still be done by active managers, even if the majority of assets become fully indexed. Now, if you ever got there to a point where, you know, let's say, you know, 95% of our assets are trading, very little trading by active managers, what you would expect then is a self-correcting process, because then there would be much larger rewards. If the market is inefficient, the thing, active managers keep the market efficient. When I say efficient, I mean keep prices close to fair value, right? So it's active managers whose self-interested trading produces that. You know, they say a stock is overvalued, they sell it, the stock is undervalued, they buy it. If there aren't enough active managers to do enough trading to keep prices near fair value, then the rewards to active management will go up. And you would expect that to revitalize the active management business, at least to some degree, as long as you realize that there will never be a source of outperformance for the winners other than the underperformance of the losers. I don't care whether active managers are 80% of the assets or 20% or 10%. They're trading among themselves.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the money would flow from index funds into the active managed.
Or, more like the flow into index would slow down and stop. That's likely what happened.
Yeah, probably. Also, we got a question here from Andre also on your views on smart beta factor systematic funds. But you wrote actually, I think just a couple of days ago, or maybe a week or two, the a collection of factors. And then you wrote like this: traditional investors think of portfolios, whether active or indexed, as collection of stocks. We can equally think of portfolios as collections of factors. Could you say something about that?
Yeah. When I say factor, I'm in the academic sense, so an attribute with which excess returns are thought to be associated. So
if you would look what kind of factors are that?
Yeah. Well, now example, we got nerdy.
Good example. Fama and French, the two professors, did a study maybe 30 years ago now. Saying small size and cheap valuation are factors of return. In other words, they are qualities with which excess returns tend to be associated. Low volatility, we've written about that a lot, as a factor of return. Momentum, sometimes regarded as a factor. Quality, strong balance sheet profitability, sometimes regarded as a factor. Factor, and so as you think about a portfolio, and I go back to my younger days, many years ago, when I was a budding portfolio manager, and you'd look at the way active managers describe their portfolios, it would be a portfolio literally of stocks, but really of stories, because they could tell you, you know, a story about why they own each of these stocks. This company has great value, you know, great new product pipeline. This is a turnaround with a good new management. There's always a story. There's a reason. They'll call it an investment thesis, which is a perfectly good thing to call it. But there's always a thesis, a story. That's how active managers think of their portfolios. And when I became interested more in systematic quantitative management, I began to realize you could equally well say that the same portfolio is a collection of exposures to various factors. It has a certain tilt towards smaller companies, has a certain tilt toward cheaper companies or more expensive companies, a tilt toward higher volatility, lower volatility. And those things can be very powerful engines in explaining the performance of active funds or of individual stocks or of factor indices. You mentioned factor index or smart beta, and I might as well say, no, I hate the term smart beta. I just despise it. And the reason for that, I have a reason. The reason for that is that to call an index a smart beta index implies that there are other indices that are kind of dumb beta, like the S&P 500. Is that dumb beta? Well, it outperforms 90% of all active managers. Is it really that dumb? Seems pretty smart to me. But the factor index is, and I'll give a good example, low volatility. We have one of my favorite indices, S&P 500 low volatility index, the 100 least volatile stocks in the S&P 500. I own it myself, I confess. I admit my bias. I had a small role in helping to design it. What do I say about low volatility? It's designed to give you not the return of an asset class like the S&P 500 or the return of a sector like technology or utilities or whatever, designed to give you a pattern of returns that is less volatile, hence the name, on both the upside and the downside, which means that in a rising market, it will probably underperform. In a falling market, it will probably outperform. I personally like that pattern of returns. Other people might not, but I like that index because it gives me a pattern of returns that I find particularly congenial. And what I've always said about I think in the collection of factors piece and some other work we've done, is that a factor index can very reliably give you access to a factor. Low volatility, if you look at, again, take that example, I'm doing some work on it now. If you look back over time periods as short as 2 years, there is no 2 year time period when S&P 500 low volatility has not been less volatile than the S&P 500. There are none. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of two-year time periods when low volatility has underperformed the S&P 500. And the same could be said, you know, mutatis mutandis, of other factor indices. So what I always tell people about factors is you should think about investing in factors if the factor itself is something that you find attractive, find congenial. If you view the factor as a means of outperforming, even if you're right in the long run, and I've made arguments, and I'm on record saying, low volatility has a good record. There's good theoretical and empirical reason to believe it will outperform over time. But you're much more likely to have buyer's remorse if you buy it for performance than if you buy it for the nature of the thing in itself.
Mm. Well said. Well said. I really like that. I think we're going to round off. Is there a question we should have asked? Is there something some area we didn't cover which you find important?
No, I think you've got them all. I mean, we talked about Michael Jordan. That's very important to me. We talked about the lion catches the slowest zebra in the herd. So no, those are important points. But I think you got them.
Yeah. So a question we ask all our guests on our show is like, what's the worst financial advice that you have encountered during your career?
Oh my gosh. I think. And this won't surprise you given what we've talked about earlier. I think the idea that you can outperform, or that more likely by somebody selling to you that I can outperform, that he can outperform, is very bad advice. It's occasionally true, which makes it kind of pernicious because it's hard to resist. But as I said earlier, the best, if you keep in mind the odds are against you, and if you choose to believe that a particular manager or you yourself can outperform, the odds are against you. You may be right, but you're taking a low probability bet.
Finally, so you have already given some tips of studies or articles. Is there any other book or papers, like a study that you really like would like to recommend? And it can be a non-fiction and non.
I'll give you a book recommend. I mean, professional books.
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned some articles. I think The Loser's Game, The Arithmetic of Active Management are two of the best, the very, very best. Hal Arbitz, The Nature of the Game is more turgid, but it's got some good insight. And for a book, just kind of a history of indexing, there's a book called Trillions by Robin Wigglesworth, who writes for the Financial Times. Very good. Came out about a year and a half ago. But really, really quite good as a history of how indexing came to be.
Thank you very much for joining our show. It was really, really appreciated. I know we've been looking forward to it, the community have been looking forward to it, and we hope that we might come back in the future and ask follow-up questions and talk about new Spiva scorecards.
Yeah, absolute pleasure to be with you. I appreciate it very much.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.